Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for September the 17th, 2018. This is David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey there, David, and good evening, everybody. Tonight, we have two major segments in the show. First, we will hear from six veterans talk about their military service and challenges they faced when they returned to civilian life. Then, in the second segment, we will continue our prior week's discussion of some current projects we are working on. But first, I'd like to acknowledge two sponsors of our show, Joyce and Joe Schiparoli, whose financial contribution helps us provide this weekly show for the benefit of veterans and their families across the country. I also wish to remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, your comments and questions, so you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Richard. For our first segment of the show, we're going to hear from six veterans who tell their experiences in war and afterwards as they return to civilian life. These interviews are courtesy of the VA's Make the Connection series, available on YouTube, in which the VA encourages people to share. In the first tape, we hear from Tom, who served in the Army Air Corps between 1945 and 1948, and then again in the infantry in Korea. He returned home and had trouble functioning as he had before the war. After his wife died, Tom turned to alcohol and drugs to try to cope. When he went to the VA for help with past injuries, his doctor recognized symptoms of PTSD. Treatment and support from other veterans have helped him turn his life around. Doug, if you'll please roll the first tape.
I'm Tom, and I served in the Army Air Corps in 1945 until 1948. I was going to come out and make a career, and I joined the inactive reserves to go back in to keep my rank and time. And my GI Bill. I found a good job, good money, good pay, and then they called me up in August of 1950. I had a report the 1st of September, and I went to Korea, and I was there until 1951, and it was a living hell, and it was tough in that infantry. And the worst thing about it, you know, buddies and friends are close, you lose. It makes you sick at your stomach. It's tough, but this is one of the things that when I came back, it threw me. After I came home, I had problems. I had nobody. I didn't know how to work them out. You know, I couldn't walk very good, and I had some problems to hold my job down. You know, but I had a problem with my remembering things and that and. I thought, you know, weak. You know, I was weak. You know, man doesn't leave things like that bother him. And the trouble is, if you keep too many things, and you don't inside it, you can hurt yourself. I lost my wife through death, and being a widower and 34 and a half years married, it knocked me, and I didn't know what to do. Well, I drank too much. I took the pills and I drank, took the pills and I dropped the pills. And then I had to go into a detox, which I did. And I went in and I changed. I don't go and get souse. I went to the VA, you know, because I was having more problems with my injuries. And I went up there and I talked to him up there, and the doctor said, "I'm nervous." I was nervous. You know, I'd jump, somebody, noise behind me, somebody up and tap me, I'd jump. And then they told me I had post-traumatic stress. And I, what's that, you know? And they told me what it was. And after associating with the guys, my buddies up there, who had the same problem, I understood my problem. I went to a psychiatrist and told me what to do, you know, talked with me. And the best thing for me, even today, when I go up and I spend the time with my buddies up there, and we're all in the same boat, we serve together. I see them, it's like a shot of adrenaline. We can talk, we can say things our whole life that we kept inside, and we can tell each other, and we understand each other, you know. And everything's between us, it stays in that room. Don't wait until you're 70, 80 years old and find out what you have to do. Look, you know, look how much you waste. As for my fellow veterans that have that problem, it's out there. It's there. Use it to help yourself. The country will help you.
Well, we'd like to thank Tom, a veteran, including of infantry service in the Korean War, who described what he went through. We'd like to thank him for sharing his experience and his insight and his encouragement to other veterans and really the importance of getting support from other veterans. Richard, before we go to our second veteran tonight, why don't you offer your thoughts?
Well, you know, his point about, you know, getting into VA and getting help, and you know, I tend to be tough on the VA on our show, and that's just because I'm in the trenches with so many veterans that I see a lot of stuff that bothers me. But yes, the VA does, you know, they do have their programs that have helped veterans, and if anything, it's the message that of hope that there is help out there. So if a veteran is returning home, you know, you don't have to feel alone. You can't get help into VA, there are other resources for you, and I'm sure the VA can even point you in those resources. Listen to our show. We have a lot of people that on the show have resources. So the point, I guess, is that there's hope for veterans returning home, and don't hide in your home. Don't let whatever issues are going on inside the brain between the ears fester, because that will only get worse. So let me go to the next tape. We're going to hear from Marcus. He's a Marine Corps veteran. Marcus lost his leg in an IED blast. He used alcohol to try to cope. He felt depressed and had problems in his marriage. Therapy helped him quit drinking and find meaning and purpose in life. And through marriage counseling, Marcus and his wife have built a stronger foundation. Doug, please roll tape number 2. A combat veteran overcomes many challenges after an IED blast.
My name is Marcus. I'm in the Marine Corps, or was in the Marine Corps, and I served both in Iraq and Afghanistan. I joined the Marine Corps to do essentially one thing, and that was to go fight. I joined at the age of 17, just out of high school. I went home and I told my mom that I wanted to join the Marine Corps, that I was going to become a Marine. And so within the Native American cultures, I believe that, or I actually see that not a lot of them give the initial support of being in the military. And a lot of that might come from, you know, the pass down of historic events that Native Americans and the U.S. government have had in the past. So to be a part of the Marine Corps in this day and age was definitely a big step for my family. I've done 3 deployments to Iraq, and so that was 2006, 2007, 2008. I did reenlistment then, and I went to Marine Unit in Camp Pendleton and did a deployment to Korea and Afghanistan. On October 9th in 2010, I stepped on a 25-pound pressure-plated IED, and that resulted in the loss of my left leg above the knee. My life in every aspect had to be adapted. Now I was no longer, physically healthy. I was an amputee. You know, there was a level of depression from when I initially got injured. And my thought process with depression was that it was because people just weren't strong enough to handle, you know, trauma. And then I went through a depression and I could not help what my body was doing. I went to the mental health care professionals and I said, hey, this is what my daily lifestyle is looking like right now. And I need you to sort of help me figure out what I need to do to get out of this. For me, myself, it was difficult because I had never gone through therapy. I didn't know exactly what it was we were supposed to talk about. There was definitely a lot of denial about the level of stress that I was going through in dealing with a lot of the things that I had endured while being a Marine. I mean, it was almost like a full-time second job trying to go back and not necessarily undo what happened to myself, but to try to just put it in a different perspective that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to change anything, but I could live with it and have that progression in life. It's been about 7 years since I lost my leg in Afghanistan. And that transitional time, even 7 years sounds like an ample amount of time, but 7 years to me has been a series of moments in my transition. So maintaining my marriage is definitely moments in my transition. Being Native American, there was sort of like this taboo mindset that Native Americans couldn't handle alcohol. There was a lot of people who, you know, probably joked with me about it, like, oh, you know, Chisholi's Native American, he can't handle drinking. But I think there were a lot of things that I wasn't being taught how to deal with internally about my experiences in the Marine Corps and a lot of the deployments that I had done. Drinking sort of was just like an outlet for me that became too much of an outlet. I met my wife in the first year as a Marine. And when it came to drinking, you know, she was like, hey, if we live together, if we start a family, you know, there's a side of this that, you know, needs to stop or, you know, slow down in a bit so you could pay attention to you know, fulfilling the needs of being a dad, the needs of being, you know, a husband. So there was a little bit of struggle there, but, you know, I went to the resources that were there and available and said, you know, that I had an issue. Those programs were put in place to try to catch people before they got to the point where they can't take back, you know, they couldn't take back some of the mistakes that they would make. As my lifestyle changed and I became more involved in my marriage, as I became more involved at being a dad, she wanted me to understand how to improve that as well. Marriage counseling was definitely a good thing. I don't push that on people like it's something they need to do, but it's a good resource. It's a good outlet. The change I think is it's a steady progress for myself. I've gone back a number of times to just try to, you know, get tune-ups or get some realignments. All the stuff that I've was given before through mental health, through substance abuse programs, through marital counseling, it had meaning, it had purpose in my life. You actually go through, you know, some type of reconstruction that help you, you know, just take your experiences, your workplace, your marriage, your relationship with your kids, and the rest of your family and your friends. All of those experiences help you just become better at those things.
Well, I'd like to thank Marcus for sharing his experience, and hopefully veterans can appreciate his advice, how therapy helped him quit drinking and overcome the problems he suffered after an IED blast severely injured him. He lost his leg in Afghanistan. So I'd like to thank Marcus for sharing his experience with us. The next veteran we'll hear from...
David, if I may, let me just chime in on that one. First, it's great to hear a good story. We hear so many bad stories when it comes to veterans. It's nice to hear a good story. But one of the things that he said there that I hope people, when they were listening, I don't know if they picked up on it, but he said it's a steady progress and a steady process. Well, that's what recovery is all about. Anybody who has been in through recovery will tell you, you know, you don't walk in to whether it's your first meeting or your first therapy group and walk out and say, wow, I'm good. Let's move on. Now I can start my life again. No, that's hardly what happens. In fact, most people walk out going, I can't do this. you know, I'm listening to all these great, wonderful stories. This isn't me. I'm not going to get it. I don't know if I have the dedication to do that. Well, this young man, Marcus, shows that you can do it, and he did it. I mean, you know, he lost his legs, he had alcohol abuse, marriage problems, and he stuck with it, and he survived. And it's a, you know, it's a very powerful thing that he said about it being a steady process, and he stuck with it, and he has to go back and retool, go back and learn all those tools that he learned from in his, you know, first 6 months to a year, 2-3 years, and that's also part of the recovery process. You might end up going to 2 or 3 meetings a week, or you know, you'll probably end up going to meetings for the rest of your life. But obviously, it's paid off for Marcus. He saved his marriage, and he seems to have a very positive viewpoint on life today. And any veteran who heard that story, who may be in the initial stage of recovery, whether it's for alcohol or drug abuse, or you have problems in your marriage, listen to Marcus's story again and grab some hope from that. It's a great, great story. All right, David, back to you.
Yeah, those are excellent points. Our next veteran that we'll hear from tonight is a Vietnam veteran. After the war, like so many veterans, he had a lot of trouble adjusting to civilian life back home, started using drugs, became very reclusive in his home. Finally, a close friend suggested he go to the VA. He started counseling and group therapy with support from his wife and others. He started moving forward. So let's hear, Doug, if you'll please roll the third tape.
My name is Samaj. I served in the Army, and I was in Vietnam. I remember it like yesterday. We were walking on this trail. The sergeant was in back of me. And I stopped because the radio strap was cutting into my chest. So I said, well, let me just stop to adjust this. So the line can't stop. Everything keeps moving. So they passed around me. They kept moving. There was a large explosion. And he stepped on an anti-personnel line, which to date, I was never really a religious person. But at that moment, I knew that there had to be a higher force working, because if I hadn't stopped to adjust the strap, I would have stepped on the mine. I got home, ironically, it's crazy, on the 4th of July, which is not the best time to come home, because, you know, you got firecrackers and stuff going off. It took me about a month or so. I stayed in the house a lot during that time. A lot of self-medication, you know, vis-a-vis marijuana. For the guys my age, that was the drug of choice. I had a difficult time. I had a very difficult time adjusting. And then I had to report back, because I still had a year of military time to complete. The transition for me from there to coming home and into being back assigned to Brooklyn, the drug thing was still prevalent. The marijuana stuff was still prevalent. That was still there as my source of coping. I was 22 when I got married, and my wife was 20, and we were clear after the divorce. We stayed together for 3 years. We weren't really connecting. Wife number two, again, it seemed like all of these relationships weaved in and out of drugs and getting high, or what have you. And she got pregnant, we lost a baby, so that was very traumatic. Then we had another child who survived. For me, having a baby was a sobering event. You know, I mean, it was real. It was real. This is not like something making up now. This is real. I had a very close friend of mine who I grew up with. And interestingly enough, he became a veteran's rep, okay? He said, you need to look about maybe going back to school, see if you can get some skills. But more so, you need to look at, talking to somebody, in the VA. Basically, they said, well, you're definitely dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. They said, you need to start coming in and meeting with a therapist, psychologist, and start getting some help, some counseling, some coaching, some support. I would get to what they call like a breakthrough, and I would pull away, you know, and stop going. And then something would happen, and I'd go back. I'd started doing groups. I started doing one-on-one counseling. So I'm having a pretty good time, you know. I'm saying like, okay, I'm making another turn now. On top of that, I got introduced to this woman, wonderful woman, by the way, who I'm still married to. She was very, very, very instrumental in supporting me, you know. And I got into, you know, I got into a couple of groups, and then after going around the block a few times, got reintegrated back into the VA and started going to them on a regular basis. You can't do it by yourself. It's not, you can't live in a cave. And I tried that. I really did. I tried to be alone, be a loner, and let it, and just like the world is out there and I'm in here and I'm cool. And that was the self-medication. That's not going to do it. Because then you end up, you go through your whole life and you look back and you say, damn, like, where did 40 years go? Where did 50 years go? And now what do I have to show for my life? Because I think those veterans, those Vietnam veterans, could be very helpful to our present young men and women. They need to find a place, a space, where they can find some release and move forward in their lives.
I think that was great advice. Thanks to Samaj for sharing that with us. And his last point about how Vietnam veterans can help the current generation of veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, I think is extremely important that they share with them their experience and really the importance of reaching out and getting help. Richard, over to you.
Yeah, you know, he talked about, and I made that comment earlier in the show about, you know, not staying home and letting it fester. You know, you got to get out and you got to talk to somebody, which is the first step in recovery, is one-on-one, you know, whether it's by phone or, you know, at a coffee shop or, you know, on the basketball court or anywhere you feel comfortable. Just one-on-one with another veteran and share your experiences, strength, and hope. And that's exactly what he did. And obviously, it's worked for him. And just another great example of the fact that with a little bit of work, a little bit of hope, you know, you can adjust and get back into civilian life. But you got to put the work in. You know, prayers are great, but prayers aren't going to be the one what gets you by. You got to actually do the work. You got to go to the meetings. You got to go get the therapy. You got to go talk to somebody. That's a great lesson. Our next veteran is Linda, a combat trauma nurse. She had symptoms of PTSD after her service in the Army and Air Force. She talks about specific therapy that helped her to recover. Doug, please roll tape 4. A combat trauma nurse focuses on her own recovery.
My name is Linda. I served in 2 different military branches. I served in the Army for 6 years and then the Air Force for 15 years. I served as a nurse during wartime, a combat trauma nurse in Balad. I worked night shift, and so every night we would be getting the most severe injuries. I watched people lose their arms or legs, their heads or life. It was almost like I told myself I didn't have a right to start having problems. Whatever you do in the military, when you're in that war zone, you're focused on your mission, you know, whatever that is, and you don't allow yourself to kind of take in what you're seeing. But the sleeping problems turned into nightmares and a little bit of isolation. I actually avoided thinking about it by becoming a workaholic. And on the outside, I looked great. I became field grade nurse of the year. I did a lot of things that I hid, a lot of my emotions. Whether you're active duty or you're a veteran, the stigma of seeking help is one of the main reasons most people don't get help. I was, I guess, lucky in the fact that I was placed with an individual that was trained in trauma therapy and would actually meet me right after my night shift. And we met and did something called prolonged exposure, which was really tough, but it worked. For me, prolonged exposure is looking at a few of those traumatic experiences. You kind of go back in time, in a way, and you reprocess that memory. You take it very slowly, and you record it. And my homework at night was to listen to that recording several times a day. It basically was the foundation of me getting better. I was able to remember things more, be more out in public. I was more aware of what triggered me and how to manage those triggers. And it's not just one thing that works. There's a combination, and it's different for each individual. I have a service dog that helped me tremendously. She allowed me to go to school, get my master's degree. She went to school with me every day, got my psychiatric nurse practitioner, and now actually I work at the VA. I've had several patients tell me, you know, I didn't lose my leg, I didn't lose my arm. You know, I feel like it's almost I shouldn't go there. The reality is there's all kinds of care there, both mental health, physical help, but also when they come, even if they don't want to continue at the VA, I give them resources in the community. Sometimes coming and talk to either a transition assistant or coming to mental health, they can give those that information out to the veterans. PTSD is treatable. You don't have to have it the rest of your life. We all in the military a lot of times think we're the only one. We don't know that there's this big wave of veterans that have been exposed to trauma that can get help. They can get better with good therapy, and it's different for each individual. Good therapy, support from the family members, and they find their mission again.
Well, that's super advice. We'd like to thank Linda, combat trauma nurse, served in both the Army and the Air Force, for sharing her experiences, her insights, and particularly it's interesting how she now works for the VA helping other veterans and emphasizes the fact that there's not just one single treatment that works effectively or works well for everyone. That may be a combination of things, and you just have to keep trying to define what works, but the bottom line is that there is therapy, there is help, and veterans just reach out and they'll find it. Richard, before we go to our next guest, any thoughts?
Yeah, you know, one thing she said that I thought was apropos, because I hear it just in representing veterans, and that is a lot of veterans will say, well, you know, I didn't lose an arm, I didn't lose a leg, and, you know, so I don't feel, basically what they're saying is I don't feel worthy to go to the VA and seek help or even seek compensation for some disabilities that they may have. And you know, my message to all veterans out there is, you know, there's plenty of VA for everybody. No matter how minimal your particular disability might be, you know, you're in there too. You know, you're covered. And you should never feel like just because, you know, you walked away with both legs and both arms, but you're still suffering from other things. Maybe it's a back injury. Maybe it's a shoulder or a neck injury or PTSD, anxiety, depression. There's recourse and help for you too. And you need to take it because you gotta remember, veterans, that, yeah, you're being affected. You were affected and you're dealing with this inside. But you're also affecting your own family members around you. So if you're not getting help and if you're not healthy, than the people who are around you, your wife or your children or your parents or whoever. They're going to be affected by it too. So when you get help, you're also getting help for your family. So, hey, David, why don't you give us another interview?
Okay, we'll have we have two more. The next one from Skylar, and then after that will be Richard, have you introduce the interview with Daniel. But the next one is Skylar, who had problems relating to civilians after he left the service. It was a big adjustment getting back to civilian life. He was always on edge. He had trouble managing his frustration. He didn't think he had PTSD, but he knew something wasn't right. After learning he had a traumatic brain injury, got him to the VA and a vet center. The resources there helped him turn his life around. So, Doug, let's listen to tape number 5, please.
My name's Skylar. I was in the Army, active duty, 6 years. I think the overall experience of being in a combat zone stays with you forever. I think my vehicle got blown up directly maybe 4 times and indirectly, you know, handful of times. So I think there's like an anxiety that sticks with you about stuff like that. Getting out of the military, it's scary, you know, because you have this whole life that you learned. For me, it was 6 years active duty in an infantry unit. Now I have to all of a sudden go be a civilian. I didn't have any Army buddies around, so I didn't have people that I could talk to and hang out with. And I kind of felt alienated from the civilian world because I didn't share anything in common. When I got out, I didn't think that I had PTSD, you know. I almost thought like PTSD was something that people who couldn't handle the intensity of their job had. And when I got out, I didn't think that I had any issues or mental health issues that would affect me in the civilian life. I found that I was having trouble controlling my emotions sometimes, my anger, my frustrations. It was easier for me to get frustrated. And when I did get frustrated, I took it more seriously, as if something serious was going on. If I was running late to a movie, I felt like I was running late to a mission and people's lives were at stake. But that wasn't the reality. That personality characteristic, that intensity, that drive makes you succeed in the military, but it doesn't in the civilian world. It alienates you. And I had to back off and let that go. And that was hard. It took a lot of other people coming up to me and telling me, hey, I think you have PTSD, or hey, I think that you have things going on that you need to talk about or you need help with. I said, no, I don't think I have PTSD. What could I have PTSD from? And I was always thinking there has to be some specific event. I don't have a constant nightmare where I wake up and I'm reliving a specific situation. I'm not constantly bunkered down in my house behind sandbags, you know, waiting for the invading army to attack. No, I don't have any of those things going on. But there is something kind of wrong, you know? I do have this agitation, this anxiety, this hypervigilance from time to time. Maybe something's not right. So I went down to the VA and they asked me, they said, have you ever been blown up before? Or have you ever been exposed to a blast? And I said, yeah, quite a few times. And they were like, how many? And I told them, and they were like, wow, well, you probably have traumatic brain injury. They helped with my memory and concentration issues and how to regulate my mood and stuff like that. And that was a really productive experience because at one point, I felt hopeless. I felt like I'm on the road to not recovering. I'm on the road, I'm on a downward spiral into some abyss of like, you know, mental disability. But working with speech pathology and TBI clinic at the VA, just, I mean, they had me turned around quick. In a few months, I was in school. I go to the Boulder Vet Center, but there's one, seems to be one located within proximity of every VA hospital. My therapist was an infantry soldier. He was deployed to Vietnam twice. And speaking with him, working with him, it made me feel comfortable to talk about my stories because I knew they were familiar to him. He knew the same emotions that I knew. He had the same feelings I had. Vet centers are great because they have this group dynamics aspect where you meet all these other combat vets. And I think that requirement alone creates a little bit of brotherhood that makes me feel comfortable walking into a group because I say, these guys know what I'm talking about. They know what I know. They've seen what I've seen. If I'm going to open up or feel uncomfortable or be in an awkward situation, it's not going to be awkward because they have those same feelings. And any advice they have for me is going to be beneficial, and you know, I can take it to heart because it's coming from somebody with the same experiences. You're a civilian now. And the best way to, I think, come to peace with all of that stuff, the best way to come to terms with all of your experiences is to talk about it, is to find other vets in the community, is to go to a local vet center down to the VA and talk about those experiences. The first thing I would say to anybody is it's not abnormal. You know, all the issues you're dealing with, you're not alone. You are not the only one. You're not weak. And the second thing I would say is go down to the VA. There's no better place to get help for a veteran than a place that is employed by veterans, run by veterans, and is designed to work around veterans. I want to be a behavioral and cognitive therapist that works with combat veterans. So I'd go from Skylar, the high school dropout, to you know, staff sergeant, to you know, Skylar, the rugby player, to doctor. You know, and that's a path that I couldn't have even started without the VA. You know, they set you up for the road to success there.
Well, that's great advice. And Richard, before we comment, let me just introduce the very last one, and then we can talk about these last two. In the final interview for this evening, we hear from a Marine veteran named Daniel, whose drinking was out of control after his service in the Marines. He made a change, got help for the sake of his family and his friends. So, Doug, please roll tape number 6. A Marine quits drinking for his daughter.
My name's Daniel. I served in the Marine Corps for 10 years, including 5 tours. I was out at Camp Lejeune for the vast majority of my time. I had a lot of anger issues going into the Marine Corps. You know, I was an addict as a teenager. I was very angry, and then joining the Marine Corps just kind of, you know, ignited all that as well. And then combat service and doing that just kind of accelerated everything. So it was. I still deal with a lot of that today. You know, it's a lot of the PTSD and the anger issues and the anxiety. Every aspect of my life was either at work with Marines, in combat with Marines, or, you know, out at a bar on a motorcycle getting drunk with, you know, Marines and bikers. You know, so it was always pretty hard, and I did a lot of bad things. You know, I hurt a lot of good people. It was very, very hard to come out of that. You know, I thought I was a war fighter. You know, I mean, you fight hard, you play hard, you drink, you sit, you're just, you know, life in the fast lane, so to speak. And that's what I enjoyed. And then when everything kind of came to a head, I was driving down Highway 24 right outside Lejeune, headed to New Bern to see a buddy of mine, and it was him and his family. When I was driving there, I stopped, got a bottle of Jameson, which was my poison of choice, and crushed that, you know, or half of that on the way up there. And when we were there, I was playing around with their son, and I was playing with him really, really rough, you know, because I was wasted. And I was drinking the whole time I was there, and I accidentally hurt him playing with him too rough. And I'll never forget the looks that I got from people that I loved and people that I cared about. And I remember just thinking, this is not my life. You know, this is not who I'm supposed to be. I have a very close relationship with God. And I think that at that time, you know, I got a smack upside the head. Like, what the hell are you doing, man? You know, and since that day is when I got sober. Well, there's a program in the Marine Corps called SARPS. That's Substance Abuse Rehabilitation Program. And that is for people who have ARIs, alcohol-related incidences, and also for people who want to receive treatment. And you're in a class with a handful of other guys seeking help, and you have instructors coming in there and, you know, just discussing the different things that different challenges you're going to meet while trying to be sober. And then on top of that, when you're interacting with other guys who need help and you're starting to help each other and you're seeing that and realizing that makes you want to do more. Once I got out in December of 14, my daughter was born that next month in January 2015. So I left Camp Lejeune. I'm away from everyone I knew, my house, everything like that, and I moved across the country to California because my fiance, she's a senior chief in the Navy. She's stationed here at Pendleton. So I went from being an active duty Marine to being a stay-at-home dad overnight in less than 30 days. Even though I had my daughter, it was still really hard, and I had a lot of slip-ups. You know, it was my fiance was the one who was super supportive, you know, trying to get me help because, I mean, I got cabin fever really quick being a stay-at-home dad. So what I did was I checked into the local vet center in Temecula. And all they do is, you know, it's counseling and help with VA benefits, so on and so forth. They do whatever they can. It's all vet run. And, you know, got rubbed elbows with a lot of other vets, you know, and it's always good to be able to, you know, surround yourself with other good people. Fighting that stigma of that you don't need anyone's help is step one. And that was what helped me, was just realizing that help is not a bad thing. You know, asking for help is probably the strongest thing you can do. Carrying around that emotionally mental baggage, you know, it hardens you, you know, it hardens your heart. And it's hard to be like that when you have other people who have been through the same things you've been through and who have dealt with them in all different kinds of ways. It helps you in immeasurable ways to try to move past all the things that are going wrong. You got to be able to honestly and accurately look at your own life and decide if this is the way you want to be, if this is who you want to be, if you want to be a better father, husband, person in general. You know, I mean, there's plenty of other vets out there that want to help each other, you know, that want to help you when you're having a hard time, man. You know, and like I said before, it takes him a lot of strength to be able to not only admit that, but then to seek it.
That's great, great insight. I think that you know, Daniel made several times, which was asking for help really is a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness, as many think. And before we go to our second segment, Richard, any further thoughts?
Yeah, the Daniel, when he says asking for help, is really the first step of recovery, which is admitting that you have a problem. And anyone who's been through recovery, and you know, I mentioned this on this show many times. You know, I'm in recovery now 11 years. The first big step you make is I have a problem. Admitting that you are an alcoholic, admitting you are a drug addict, and you do that in a room full of people. And the release by saying that is unimaginable. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like taking a probably one of the deepest breaths you're ever going to take in your life. Because at that point, you can then move forward and start listening to all the suggestions as to how you can get better. And you get better for your family. Now, you know, one of the things that he says in there about, you know, when you're going through recovery, yeah, you can use a family member or friends or, you know, as a reason to start. But the bottom line is you go through recovery for yourself. You don't do it for anybody else. And anybody who believes that, you're wrong. I'll tell you that right now. You're wrong because you're not going to make it. You go through recovery for yourself. And when you do that, you then will come out on the other side. And at that point, you will be helping everybody around you. But it's not the other way around. So you go to recovery for yourself. And then once you get through that and you finally get in, and you are in recovery, you will then be able to help all the other people around you. So that's just one thing I want to kind of just throw that out there. But that's all I have, David.
Thank you, Richard. I hope our listeners have gained some helpful insights from listening to these six veterans tonight who shared their stories, their own experiences, and we want to move to our next segment of the show. September, as many of you may know, is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and every week at the end of the show, and we'll do it again tonight, Richard and I remind everyone of two valuable VA programs. One is coaching into care, and the other is the suicide crisis line, which is not just for suicide prevention, but it's crisis, any type of crisis the veterans or the families are going through. In some news from the VA, earlier this summer, the VA opened its third veterans crisis line. This call center is in Topeka, Kansas, on the campus of the Colmory O'Neill Veterans Center. They're in Topeka, and the VA's focus continues to be, as then-acting VA Secretary Peter O'Rourke said, is to provide 24/7 world-class suicide prevention and crisis intervention services. The VA is always striving to provide immediate care to veterans in a crisis, and the Veterans Crisis Line is an important part of that life-saving mission. The Topeka Bay Center was opened because there was an increased demand in recent years. The VA has two other crisis center call centers. One's located in New York and the other is in Georgia. A few statistics to get a sense of really how much these crisis lines are needed. Since 2007, when the VA launched the Veterans Crisis Line responders have answered over 3.5 million calls. 3.5 calls. They've initiated the dispatch of emergency services to callers who are in imminent crisis nearly 93,000 times. And they engaged over 397 requests for chat services. They even have a text service, and they answered nearly 92,000 requests for text services. And they forwarded more than 582,000 referrals to local VA suicide prevention coordinators on behalf of veterans to ensure continuity of care with veterans, their local VA providers. We'll mention it again later on the show, but I want to take the opportunity. Again, it is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month, and the Veterans Crisis Line toll-free number, in case anyone is interested, is 1-800-273-8255, and then press 1. Again, the crisis line is 1-800-273-8255, and press 1 for the Veterans Crisis Line. The VA has many resources to help veterans, and one of their outstanding resources regarding PTSD is at the website ptsd.va.gov. You check that out for the resources of the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. Richard, over to you.
Yeah, you know, David, that's terrific. The VA has that crisis line. That they're adding a third one. You know, any veterans out there who might be struggling with this, if you get to that point where you're really down and out, pick up the phone, make the phone call. Just that little moment of hesitation from doing something that could be devastating to your family and senseless, basically, when there is help out there for you. And you heard a whole bunch of people tonight who had a lot of problems, and they got help, and they're better today, and they're leading productive lives, as we could tell. So, you know, that moment of hesitation might be the difference between something real bad and possibly something, you know, turning out to be really good in your future.
Okay, thanks. Richard, still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Back to you.
Let's go ahead and, in our last segment before we wrap up tonight, spend a few moments talking about the project we're working on that may be of interest not only to veterans but all Americans, hopefully. Richard Hurley and I are in the early stages of a multimedia program to inform the public and government officials about the cost of war, the cost of militarism, and the importance, the practicality, and the possibilities of peace building around the world. You can learn more from the website stopwar.today. That's stopwar.today, not .com or .org. It's also on Facebook. Search for the phrase Stop War Today on Facebook search engine. You'll find it. It's a project of multiple organizations and individuals, including not only Richard Hurley and myself, but also film director Greg Lovett, in collaboration with the Cost of War Project of Brown University, as well as the help of other groups and experts and scholars in those fields. The multimedia project will be created and publicized in collaboration with a nonprofit organization called Image Essays. You can check out their website. It's easy to remember. It's imageessays.org. That's image, I-M-A-G-E-E-S-S-A-Y-S, imageessays.org. And if you're able and interested, please consider making a donation to the cause through the website, or there's an address in case you wanted to mail a check. So it's an important project. Again, the goal is an ongoing series of mini documentaries, each about 15 minutes in length, which will explain and analyze the full spectrum of the cost, the effects, consequences of the post 9/11 wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other areas of the world, as well as what appears to be a never-ending, self-perpetuating global war on terror. So hopefully it will be of great value and interest. That's certainly our goal. So, Richard, any thoughts before we reach the end of the show tonight?
Yeah, and we're going to be talking a lot about our project, the film, and everything we intend to do with it. But, you know, I just want to leave the listeners with one thought. One of our goals, when I say ours, David and my, our goal for this project is to change the paradigm when it comes to conflict abroad. And rather than, you know, constantly doing the military buildup to again, hesitate, maybe get to the peace table, look at other options, rather than spending trillions of dollars on war and in preparation for all the different filming we're doing. You know, I've been reading a lot of good books on from the Cost of War Project. And I got to tell you, the facts are there, and it's very disturbing when you start to see the numbers and how much we spend on war and what we could be doing with that money other than sending it and spending on war. So a lot to talk about in that project, and look forward to, you know, many years of putting this together and educating the public. But again, the bottom line is we need to change the paradigm. Back to you, David.
That's well said. Yep. And as you said, Richard, it's going to be an ongoing series. It's not just going to be one or two documentaries.
Hey, David, can I just jump in real fast? You know, one of the questions when I've been doing this, and I have I'm talking to people about our project, I ask everybody one question. Have you ever heard of the United States Institute of Peace? I have not yet met one person who's familiar with this department when it's a department that's being funded by Congress every year. Obviously, it's not getting the attention that it needs, and that's just amazing, and that's another example of why we need to change the paradigm.
Yeah, we're about out of time, so I'll just make one quick add-on to that. United States Institute of Peace was created by Congress in 1984. Its current annual budget is just under $38 million. You may say, $38 million, that's a lot of money. I wish I had that amount. But if you compare that to the cost of a single F-22 fighter jet, which costs about three times that amount of money, and then compare that to the DOD budget of over $700 billion a year, proportionately, that's like comparing the DOD budget. If the DOD budget were proportionately, let's say, $700,000, then the USIP, United States Institute of Peace budget, would be a mere $38. So it shows you the spending of money reflects priorities. So it's not surprising that people, most Americans, have never even heard of the United States Institute of Peace, but they certainly heard of the DOD. We're about out of time, Richard, so if you want to wrap it up quickly with the our closure.
Absolutely. The Coaching in the Care program that we talk about every week, it helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching in the Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call, toll-free at 1-800-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the VA's Coaching in the Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has a Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
I'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli, and Corey and Hurley Law Group. We'd also like to thank our producer at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. Hope you'll tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, hope you have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.